Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Hello, welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University and the TurfNet Media Group. And today we're frankly speaking with assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Professor Paul Koch. Before we get to our conversation with Paul about all things winter diseases, continuing with our theme of low temperature issues that we talked about last week with Kevin Frank, we'll get to the pathological component of this with Professor Koch today. Before we get there, I'd like to remind you about cool stuff going on at TurfNet.com. This past week, an excellent webinar by Professor Jim Brosnan, the University of Tennessee, on weed control issues. And coming up soon, we have Dennis Hurley on from the Turf Drainage Company of America, obviously talking about drainage, and Mickey McCord talking about safety programs on golf courses. A quick review of the blogs, of course, Randy Wilson and his great career advice, Peter Braun talking about his time in Ireland, Matt Leverich and Jim McLaughlin on career and technology issues, myself and Dave Wilbur on agronomic issues, but my favorite blogger of all, superintendent up in Prince Edward Island, Paul McCormick, and he wrote an excellent blog post about home and home is where the heart is, an excellent blog. But really, my recommendation for the week comes from John Kiger's latest video, Black Girls Golf. Everything in this video is dead on for the kinds of things that need to be happening to grow the game of golf and to keep golf a viable sport. So you can see that there's lots going on at TurfNet this week and always, both with the bloggers and the webinars. And when we come back, we'll begin our conversation, frankly speaking, with Professor Paul Koch.
From day to day and season to season, you never know what nature has in store for you. That's why Revolution from Aquatrols is trusted by superintendents worldwide in a variety of climates. More than 10 years of university trials have shown that Revolution is a superior surfactant for optimizing soil moisture. Whether you're battling too much rain or not enough, Revolution can help you attain the proper moisture balance in the root zone for healthy, resilient turf and drier, firmer playing surfaces. Revolution from Aquatrols, the world leader in
And welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Frank Rossi, Cornell University and the TurfNet Media Group. And with me is Professor Paul Koch in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Paul is a Wisconsinite through all his education at the UW-Madison. And I was interested to read a former bacteriology major, also a former staff member at the Bog and Black Wolf Run, two of the great golf courses along the eastern side of the great state of Wisconsin. What was it like working at the Kohler Golf Properties, Paul?
Well, Frank, you know, it's a great experience. They have, you know, there's some spectacular properties, and it's a big crew. You have a lot of resources there, and you get to experience what big-time golf is like. So you experience the Black Wolf Run, you go over and experience Whistling Straits, and it's really a good experience, and that's where I did my internship, and I would highly encourage anybody looking for an immersive internship experience to go and contact the guys at Kohler. I think it's a really good experience.
I love that way you say that, immersive, which means you basically work 100 hours a week.
You do, but you do everything from raking bunkers to spraying greens. So you do everything, and you get a good experience for how big-time golf is managed.
Great, and I saw that you mentored under Ron at Black Wolf Run, and he's had his hand in a lot of students coming out of the great state of Wisconsin. Ron's quite a fine guy, isn't he?
He is. He's an excellent guy, and I sure learned a lot under Rod and all the guys there, Jeff and Mike Lay. They're a really good group. So it's a good place to intern, and yeah, they've pumped out some pretty good interns over the years.
Yeah, and of course, the thing that I like that we both share and a lot of us share in this business, I think a lot of people assume, you know, because we're academics, we don't really sort of understand much about the practical side of golf turf management. But like me, you've got a lot of practical experience on a golf course as well, and I'm assuming that's been really helpful, particularly in the work you've been doing around low-temperature diseases.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, interned and worked on a golf course for six consecutive summers, fully planned on going and becoming a golf course superintendent before the research bug hit me my senior year of undergrad. So I think that's hugely important to have an understanding of how superintendents manage the golf course and have that hands-on experience for how golf courses are managed so you can really develop the applied research that needs to be done to help the superintendent do their job.
Great. And so I love that, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. That is absolutely dead on. But a lot of our abilities to focus on this applied work, particularly for us that sort of endeavor to study this stuff, really begins with some of the basics, and that's where I want to start our conversation, Paul. Let's have just a general conversation about the organisms, right, these low-temperature organisms that we assume are primarily gray and pink snow mold, but we know, you know, within gray snow mold, there's Ischicariensis and Incarnata. I don't know that we differentiate in Microdochium or what people call Fusarium. So why don't we start with the grays first? What do we know? What do you think every superintendent should know about understanding the biology and ecology of, we'll start with the gray snow molds. You know, how do we get it? When do we get it? How does it behave kind of stuff?
So I think the one thing you need to know about gray snow mold is that we always say that it requires snow. And yes, gray snow mold requires snow for an extended period of time, but the reason it requires snow is because the snow moderates the temperature in northern climates. So these gray snow mold fungi, the Typhlops fungi, they infect at temperatures anywhere between, you know, zero in Fahrenheit, it's anywhere between 32 and 42 degrees Fahrenheit. But if you have frozen soils, if you have soil temperatures that are below freezing, those fungi aren't going to infect. They're not going to cause any disease. So you need that snow cover there to cause disease. So that's why the snow is important, and that's why you need that long duration. They're just slow-growing fungi. They start to germinate from their sclerotia or their survival structure somewhere in mid to late fall. So somewhere right about now, we're starting to see these gray snow mold fungi start to come out of the sclerotia, and they will slowly colonize the leaf tissue and infect over the winter, and then when the snow melts in the spring, that's when you see the damage.
Ecologically, is this really a strategy that organisms take on sometimes because they're not aggressive growers? I mean, obviously there's not a lot of competition microbiologically at this time in that system. So is part of their success due to the fact that they're growing when not much other stuff is?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So it's a niche environment for them. So they don't grow particularly fast, but they can grow and infect better than basically anything else. So it's a matter of them out-competing everything else at those cold temperatures. So it's the niche that they have developed that allows them to cause disease on turf in the winter.
And so within the grays, where do you think most of the people that are, you know, battle gray snow mold throughout the United States, how much does whether it's Ischicariensis or Incarnata matter from a control perspective?
Well, from a control perspective, it matters a lot. And so typically we think of Incarnata as being the less severe of the two Typhlops. So Incarnata is going to require approximately 60 days of continuous snow cover. That number is certainly variable. And so typically with Incarnata, it's more of a foliar infection. So in the spring, we'll see the symptoms recover at a faster pace than we would with Ischicariensis. Ischicariensis is much more, typically we see infection in the crown region. It's areas of the country that have the longest winters, basically 90 days of continuous snow cover or longer. So the upper Great Lakes, the Rocky Mountain West, these are areas that have the really prolonged winters. And they're the ones that see predominantly Ischicariensis, and they're the ones that predominantly have the biggest problems controlling those Typhlops. So I think of Ischicariensis as a more severe gray snow mold than Incarnata. Certainly you can get significant damage from Incarnata, but the problems that are caused by Ischicariensis are generally more severe, or at least more longer lasting to recover from in the spring and the summer.
You know, it's fascinating, the analogy you just made. I just read your article. The Grassroots just showed up on my desk this week, and you said the same thing about failure anthracnose. The difference is between those problems, and I think it's good for the listeners to hear that, in general, we can recover from foliar disease problems, like you said in that you just said about snow mold, and that you said in your most recent Grassroots Wisconsin Superintendent newsletter article, that foliar anthracnose behaves in a similar way.
Yeah, no, that's a good good comparison, and I'm glad you're still getting and reading the Grassroots issues from here in Wisconsin.
That's by far the best, still the best newsletter pound for pound that I see from some of the superintendents. Now, Paul, let's shift a little bit and go to the pink snow mold, the Microdochium patch. You know, historically, obviously snow cover not required here, but what would you tell people about managing that? Should we start thinking about managing that now with some cool wet weather coming, or is it mostly something we worry about in the spring?
Right, so with pink snow mold / microdochium patch / fusarium patch, we have all these different names for it, and it does take on a completely different appearance and sort of way it behaves depending on where you are in the country and depending on those conditions you have. So in the Midwest and the Northeast, when we see pink snow mold act as a snow mold where it develops under snow cover, it actually acts more like a traditional snow mold where you get like the large circular patches of tan to bleach turf and you apply your fungicide in the late fall. Other times, you know, including in the Midwest, but especially on the Pacific Northwest and in the UK and Scandinavia, you know, there you can actually have pink snow mold that almost act more like dollar spot, where you get the very small spots that are reddish colored, and that's where you see some of the cultural practices like the rolling that they were doing at Oregon State has shown to actually significantly reduce that type of fusarium patch or microdochium patch. As far as the snow mold type of fusarium or the snow mold type of microdochium that we typically see more of here in the Midwest and the Northeast, the problem with that is that it's a much faster growing organism. So if we apply something now, if you're expecting cool wet weather that may produce microdochium, sure you can go ahead and spray now, but you'll still need to make your traditional snow mold, late fall snow mold application whenever you traditionally make that, whether it be now or in a couple weeks. And the problem with microdochium is it grows so much faster than the tifulas that when there is a gap or when there's a breakdown in the fungicide coverage, it can really exploit that gap and infect and cause symptoms relatively quickly compared to the tifulas.
Okay, so then there's that sort of issue, are they working together at all? In other words, do you get some predisposition to gray snow mold when, you know, you might get a little bit of pink starting to infect, and then over time if the snow cover persists, Paul, will that set it up for maybe more severe gray snow mold? Can they work in concert to exacerbate the injury?
I don't know. To be blunt, I've never seen any papers that are looking at that, and it would depend on, you know, the mechanisms for infection of each pathogen. So if the mechanisms of infection of the microdochiums and the tifulas are similar, then sure, if the microdochium breaks through that defense response of the plant first, then it could lead to increased amounts of gray snow mold. I've never seen that. We've seen patches all the time where you have pink snow mold right next to gray snow mold, and actually sometimes we've seen pink snow mold growing on top of gray snow mold in the same exact patch. So to answer your question, does one lead to more of the other? I don't know, and I've never seen any direct evidence of that either in our own trials or in any published research.
Okay. Well, before we go to break, I want to get one more piece of information from you, and that is sort of the role of humidity. I mean, you talked about frozen soil. You talked about snow cover. You know, we know guys use covers, and I know that there's a lot of questions about, Kevin Frank and I talked about this a lot, you know, about to do or not to cover or not to cover. And in all those cases, Paul, we're sort of changing the humidity. Is ultimately keeping that system as dry as possible helping with protection? And should we try to keep that system as dry as possible to minimize some of the problems we might have with these diseases?
Sure. Well, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. So we know that under snow cover, the humidity is significantly higher. Humidity under snow cover is anywhere north of about 60 to 75%. And we've tested that in some of our research in the past. We've had data loggers that can test that. So humidity is consistently above 60 to 75% under snow cover. Now, when you get down to very shallow snow depth, then that humidity decreases quite a bit, usually goes to less than 30 to 35%. And that's where we've seen a lot less snow cover, or a lot less snow mold.
Okay.
Now, as far as managing the disease, now, if you're talking, I think it, part of it depends on where in the country you are and the type of winter you're having. So, like, if you're concerned with desiccation, like a lot of areas of the plains are, if you're concerned with desiccation, then you're not really, you know, you don't want those areas to dry out. But certainly drier areas, less humidity is going to lead to less snow mold. But then, again, it leads to some other problems with desiccation.
Right.
Like, I know they saw a significant amount about Nebraska last winter.
Yeah, and so like everything else we've talked about with this winter issue, it tends to be a very complicated issue. You might try to solve one thing and then create another problem that's going to need something that might not be pathological and might be simple environmental stress. So when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Professor Paul Koch, University of Wisconsin, a little bit more on some of his work with tank mixing and fungicide persistence through the winter as a measure of determining efficacy.
DryJect is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and playable. Visit DryJect.com to locate your nearest DryJect service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University, TurfNet Media Group, and we're into a lively conversation with Professor Paul Koch, the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Paul, you've done some excellent work that I saw in the WTO newsletter pretty recently, where you looked at monitoring. You know, I see one paper in the grassroots where you looked at the winter environment, and you've already sort of gleaned on some of that data in our earlier conversation about humidity levels and things like that. But you've also looked at sort of the role the environment in the winter can have on fungicide persistence as a potential reason why or why not certain fungicides do or don't work. So you want to outline that nice little simple study you did and what you concluded?
Sure, sure. So this was part of a study that we started a couple of years ago, or several years ago, I guess now, looking at the impact of whether we had snow cover on the ground and what impact it had on the persistence of our snow mold fungicides. Basically, if you put your snow mold fungicide down, let's say December 1st, but you don't get a lick of snow cover till January 10th, do you have any of that fungicide there remaining? And what we found was that the presence or absence of the snow did not have a significant impact. Really, what the primary impact was any winter rainfall events or any snow melt events. That's where you lost your concentration. So you didn't lose any fungicide concentration with their just from sunlight, basically, without there being any rainfall. So really, the concentrations dropped dramatically when we saw rainfall or when we saw any sort of snow melt event. So that's really what led to the drops in fungicide concentration throughout the winter. Looking specifically at tank mixtures, we also tested solo applications of iperdione and chlorothalonil along with a tank mixture of the two, and the thinking was well, perhaps the tank mixture of the products alters somehow the persistence of either or both of those fungicides, because we know, this is well established, that multiple active ingredients applied at once as a tank mixture in the late fall will give you a much better snow mold or much better control of snow mold over the winter months. We've established that through our research, and that's been widely established for a long period of time. And so we wanted to look at that a little bit. And what we found is that tank mixing those two fungicides didn't have any impact on the persistence at all. So whether they were applied alone or whether they were applied together, they still degraded or they still were depleted most significantly after rainfall events or after any sort of significant snow melt event. So it's not the impact on fungicide persistence that the tank mixture is having. It has to have some other impact, most likely some impact on the pathogen itself.
Were you surprised, Paul, not to see more photodegradation? I can tell you myself, you know, we've sort of wondered about this in general, and I've been working a fair amount with the petroleum-derived spray oil, Civitas, and That's one of the things that's under suspicion, as maybe some of these spray adjuvant enhancements might be, reducing photo degradation. Were you surprised you didn't get more photo degradation, or is the system? Did you expect the system to be that stable?
No. Our hypothesis going in was that the areas without snow cover. So we actually physically went in, and anytime it snowed, we removed snow off of half the plots. So we anticipated that we would have an increased amount of degradation, primarily due to photo degradation, of the fungicides from the non-snow plots. So we did anticipate that there would be more photo degradation, and basically what we saw was that there was very little at all.
Huh. So what you leave us hanging, and we're sort of burying in the lead here, why does a tank mix work then?
Well, we don't know exactly. My guess at this, so now from this research, what we are proposing is that we eliminate an impact of the tank mixture on the persistence of the fungicides. So we'll take that off the table. And so it could be that one of the fungicide predisposes the fungus to another one, so it kind of almost weakens the fungus, and then you see the other fungicide come in and sort of give it the hammer, so to speak. Another possibility is that the multiple active ingredients do a better job at controlling the wider array or the multiple species of snow mold that we see out there. And with these individual species of snow mold, we can have different biotypes. So potentially more active ingredients just gives you a broader control over the multiple amounts of or the multiple types of snow mold that are out there. And then, you know, a third idea is that just putting multiple active ingredients down will really knocks back the initial inoculum. So when we're applying fungicides in the late fall, the snow molds are actually actively growing at that time. So if we can knock it back further with multiple active ingredients at that time, maybe that just sets it back for the entire winter, and we see increased control the entire winter.
Huh. Boy, that's fascinating. So many of us in the northern climates, particularly with the very cold weather coming and some moisture, you're saying could be beginning to experience some of the sclerotial germination right now, and so whenever you normally make your application, likely in the next month or so, you're probably stopping some of the stuff that's coming on right now, not to say that you don't continue to get germination throughout the entire winter, right?
Correct. And so basically, from our understanding with sclerotia right now, most of the typical sclerotia germinate right around when those surface air temperatures around 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's when they start to germinate. Again, they grow very, very slowly, but that's kind of when they're starting to grow and germinate at that point in time. We know from some other work that we did actually looking at snow mold development under covers is if you spray what I would call an early application, so probably 4 to 5 weeks prior to what you would typically make as your last spray, you significantly reduce the amount of snow mold. It's not an acceptable level, but we reduce the amount of snow mold versus the untreated control by about 60 to 80% by just this early app, making no late app at all. So again, you still had 20%, 15 to 20% snow mold, but it was significantly reduced from a non-treated. So that early application, and that would all be an impact on that initial inoculum. So that early spray that some people like to do, not everybody, but some people like to do, does have an impact, and it appears to be knocking back some of that initial growth, which with how slow growing these fungi are, then has a significant impact on the growth throughout the entire winter.
Well, now you've raised a whole nother can of worms, because, in fact, if we could avoid coating our plants through the winter, you know, when I put my environmental fate hat on, I start to wonder, what the hell's happened to all that stuff we put on through the winter when all that moisture's moving through the environment? I believe there is some data that we're certainly getting some movement of that material, and your persistence work indicates that moisture is, in fact, moving it through. So, boy, that could be a major development, that early knockdown, which in many ways is the thinking that some of the dollar spot guys are on, right, where they say, you know, an early app to knock down the inoculum might reduce the amount of dollar spot material you'd use over the course of the season.
Right. So it all goes back to the point that the fungicides that we use are not necessarily fungicides, they're fungistats, so they're preventing growth.
Right.
So if you can knock it back initially, you're just going to, if you can knock back the fungal growth initially and prevent its growth from getting to be a substantial population of the fungus, then you're gonna inhibit its growth throughout the entire season. Whether it be dollar spot, you know, if you make that early season application in May and just knock back it when it's very very limited in development, the same thing if you're talking about snow mold in the fall. If you're knocking back when it's very limited in its development, you can have a significant impact on it throughout the entire year. And if you're going to apply fungicides, if I can also put my environmental hat on for a second too, because I also have an appointment in the toxicology department here at Wisconsin, and if you can apply a fungicide 4 to 5 weeks prior to when we typically do for our snow mold applications, the environment is typically more receptive. The soil is not frozen, the soil is not near frozen, the environment is typically more receptive to those fungicides at that point in time, so there could be an environmental health aspect of making a lot of those fungicides earlier in the year. Again, we need to do a lot more research in that area, and we have a couple of research projects here going looking at environmental fate of these pesticides in kind of a snow mold situation. We need more information there, but certainly an interesting idea and one that I think needs to be further explored.
Yeah, and you know, you just look at how we've turned upside down, especially with some of Doug's work, with the way we think about late season fertility. I mean, we don't go and put that big slug of N on anymore later, and I think as we start to look at the whole system and the potential impact we might have, I'm glad to hear that you're doing that work. And I'm also really glad that you brought up the idea of growth, not growth of the fungi, but growth of the turf, which leads me to a question I get a lot, again somewhat because of my involvement with Civitas, but in general, when we've used pigmented products, pigments, dyes, paints, things like that, Paul, have you worked with them, number one? And number two, one of the things we've seen is that persistent green color through the wintertime may not necessarily enhance control, but we're finding that at least a couple of years we've done played around with it up here, that in the spring when it's darker green, you sort of get some regrowth and maybe don't get as the severity is decreased. You might have the same level of incidence, but the severity might be decreased. What would you say to superintendents considering paint or pigmented products?
I would say that we're starting. We don't have a research project specifically looking at pigments, but in our fungicide testing trials, we have most of our treatments now have pigments in them. So these are treatments that are submitted by companies, and everybody is now, that's a development that's come just in the past 2 to 3 years. Is now almost every treatment has some sort of pigment in that, and I think I would agree with you that I don't think the pigments increase the level of snow mold control. We haven't seen any evidence of that at all. But I would agree that there is a significant amount of color that remains in the spring. And so darker colors would theoretically absorb more of the sun's energy and absorb more of that heat and stimulate growth at an earlier period of time. I would say that we haven't looked at any sort of temperature differences between plots in the spring. That might be something that we may try and do next spring. But certainly the plots are significantly different in their appearance and their color, and I would think that would increase the heat absorption and stimulate growth of the turf, however small it might be, just a little bit earlier.
So we'll go to our last break after this question, Paul, and we'll wrap up our conversation after the last break. But before we go to that break, just a question about in these programs that you're trying, and because it is a recent development, are many of them saying, well, don't put it on initially, but come back in the spring and put the either the pigmented product or the stress guard or the Civitas or the green pig or the Blazon, come back in the spring? Have you done any playing around at all with spring applications of these, pigment dyes, paints to encourage recovery?
No, we haven't done any of that.
Companies, are they asking? Are they asking for some of that stuff now? Is that something we're beginning to explore?
We haven't had any requests from us or for us from those companies. All of ours have been products that were applied in the late fall as a snow mold application. And I think part of the thinking there is it's tough to get out in the spring and put anything out real early. So the part of the thinking is that maybe when it starts to get down, the ice and the snow cover starts to get down to those real shallow levels those real shallow depths, that if we have a darker green turf underneath, it could absorb some more of that light and absorb some more of that heat and help melt the snow and ice off a little bit quicker. I think Bill Kreuzer at Nebraska has been doing some of that work with spring recovery and looking at those pigments and the use of those, that recovery. We haven't tested any of that here at Wisconsin, so I can't really speak for any of that.
Okay, and when we come back from this break, we're going to put Paul on the hot seat and really ask him for some good hardcore recommendations on the kinds of products and strategies he's going to recommend for your best snowmobile control, and we'll be right back after this.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Visit MaximusAeration.com.
Okay, we're back here in our final segment of Frankly Speaking. We've been speaking with Professor Paul Koch at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. And we've covered a lot of ground, Paul, but I can't let you go until I ask you about some, you know, general recommendations you're going to give guys. Obviously, we've talked about the tank mixing component. Obviously, we've talked about the timing. I don't want you to necessarily single out particular products, but if you feel like you want to, that's fine. But here's what I can tell you. I mean, when I look out there at a lot of modern snow mold programs, you see products like Instrata, for example, that's already got 3 products in it. And we know that. I would want to say, from my limited perspective, that has seemed to be sort of a Cadillac of treatments, both in efficacy and price. But what could you say to us about sort of timing and frequency and tank mixing partners you'd recommend for the guys about ready to make their snow mold decision soon?
Sure. Well, one thing I would say is that, you know, and not to skirt the question, but there's a lot of options. So we tested last year's trials, and they're on our website at tdl.wist.edu. We tested these last winter, and we had 108 treatments in there, and over half provided excellent control. So there's a heck of a lot of treatments that will provide excellent control. The one thing I will say in a general sense, though, is I think every snowmold application should have a DMI fungicide in it. I think the DMIs are as a class, are the best class for controlling snow molds, especially the gray snow molds, but they also have pretty good efficacy against pink as well. But so I would say any application, whether you have, you know, whether you have low or moderate or high pressure, if you're going to make, you know, if you're going to put out a single application or tank mix it with something else, I would always have a DMI somewhere in that application. And then as conditions get more severe as far as snow mold pressure, I would always have a contact in there as well. So from some of our research that we've looked at, the chlorothalonil that we put in our trial persisted longer into the winter. So it was more hardier against the winter rainfall events and the snow mold events, as opposed to the upper down that we had in there. So I would always want a DMI and a contact fungicide in there, chlorothalonil being an effective one there. As far as timing is always really tricky, always one of the trickiest parts of managing golf course turf in the north. If you put it out too early, you could have a lot of rainfall. That, like I just said, it would wash it all away. If you get it out too late, you might get caught with, you know, you might get caught with snow cover in there. So the timing's always tricky. You know, one thing I will say, though, is we have seen, I don't think you need to be getting out there right as it starts to snow. I think you have a several week buffer there where you can get it out, and then if you have, you know, unless you have a lot of rainfall or some really warm temperatures, I think you're fine. So I would, as far as timing, that if you're just going to go with one late application, you know, get it out there somewhere in, you know, mid to late November for most of, you know, the northern part of the country, or early December if you're getting in more of kind of the middle part of the country as far as timing is concerned. Now, as far as that early application, I know a lot of people like to go with that. And if you have experienced significant damage in the past, then I would recommend with that. But if your program is fine, I don't see a need to fix it or change it.
Well, so let me summarize it, and then we'll get you out of here. My summary would be this. You're saying to people, obviously tank mixing and certainly your work, you know, that's demonstrating persistence and effectiveness of chlorothalonil or contact material. Now, would you, let me put you out a little bit, would you say Secure, have you got data that says Secure is a good sub for chlorothalonil?
We have got data from our research, our fungicide testing trials, that Secure is an excellent snow mold product. We didn't include Secure in our persistence research. So I don't have information on the persistence of fluazinam versus chlorothalonil, but Seqirus performed very, very well in our testing trials.
And would be considered a more contact-like material.
Correct, correct.
And so contact and the DMI seem to be the cornerstone of what you're saying. And then timing, which I was pleased to hear, there's two approaches here. If you've had a history of significant damage, I like your suggestion of the early application, and I'm going to second that knocking down inoculum early on may be a bigger help. And as you said, and I think it's critical for all of us to be thinking like this, that the environment's more receptive to that material at that time. So I like that emphasis. And then finally, that you sort of don't have to rush out there, that if you get out there when you can still get the sprayer out, those sclerotia are actively germinating, you've got time, they're going to be persistent, and long and short of it is you're oftentimes going to have success. So last question, what would be one thread, Paul, that you've seen cause the majority of failures? I mean, a lot of guys tank mix. There are, as you said, half the products and programs you tested worked. The ones that didn't work, were they simply alternative products that maybe didn't have the overall efficacy, or was it some other environmental thing that weakened certain treatments? Can you say any thread for why certain programs didn't work?
Sure. I would offer two main reasons that I've seen in my time working on snowmolds in Wisconsin since 2005, I guess. Two reasons why they predominantly fail programs. One is that we're either trying to skirt by with really low water volume, so you don't want to have to keep going back to the shop and filling up the tank, so you go with a really low water volume. You're just trying to skirt that last green. It's kind of starting to spit out of the nozzle. That's when we see a lot of control problems. And also, if we have some sort of damage or injury, whether it be from like a late season dollar spot outbreak or something, and you want to fertilize to get out of that and to get recovery prior to snow cover coming along, we also have seen several instances there where there's a lot of snowmold pressure as a result of that late season fertilization. So those are the two reasons that I can think of off the top of my head that lead to the most common control failures in our neck of the woods.
Paul, it is so great to chat with you. This has been a little mini education, especially for me, on the snow molds. And before I let you go, I wish you a safe trip to Jersey. Here you're going to see the Badgers play Rutgers.
I'm heading to Jersey tomorrow morning. I'll be on the flight, and go Badgers this weekend.
All right, Paul. Thanks very much for joining me. I look forward to seeing you at our meetings coming up.
Will do. See you next week.
And when we come back, I'll have some final comments about the winter disease management issue. And welcome back to Frankly Speaking, and my closing comments are really simple. I think that what is oftentimes viewed as an important disease management issue is sometimes not always given the thought it deserves. And we're really fortunate to have researchers and universities like Wisconsin and researchers like Paul Koch looking into this for us, give us really plain and simple recommendations for managing this really important cold weather pathogen for a lot of us in northern climates. And with the winter we had last year, the last thing we need is more problems from this particular pathogen. Paul gave us excellent, simple strategies for understanding and using the basic biology of the organism, and then implementing those control programs at the right time, and a lot of forethought given as we move forward to the role that some of these applications might make on environmental quality. And we'll look forward to hearing more about that from Paul's program. And in the meantime, I'm Frank Rossi. Welcome, and thank you for coming out and listening to Frankly Speaking here on the TurfNet Radio Network, and we'll look forward to chatting with you on our next episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.